my tools are diet, exercise, behavior change. And so from that point of view, it's okay, what is my trigger and how in the world am I going to decouple my response from that trigger? And in some cases, I think it might be just finding an acceptable stand-in for now, that maybe we aren't going to necessarily stop eating entirely, but what's something that I can put in place that's a better choice from what I'm currently doing?
Hello and welcome to the Consistency Project Podcast. My name is Patrick Cummings. As always, I'm here with E.C. Sinkowski. Every week on the show, we aim to simplify the science of nutrition, health, and fitness, cutting through the noise to focus on the principles and practices that will help you perform better, feel better, and live better. Thanks so much for tuning into the show this week. Hey, EC, how are you?
We're going to hack hunger, I think. We're going to do it.
We're going to explore the many multifaceted reasons why we eat. Finally, a couple years in, we're just going to go right to it. Why are we eating at all? We're going to focus on the distinction between hunger and appetite and how cravings fit into the picture. And we'll challenge some common beliefs regarding blood sugar levels and insulin's role in hunger, highlighting the surprising satiating power of foods like potatoes. That's right. Team potato over here.
That's right.
Before we jump into that conversation, though, just a quick reminder about the Three Pillars Method Masterclass. You hear us talking about it a lot because it's happening again soon. Jump in before April 17th. Join EC on this 10-week nutrition masterclass that she's been putting together for many, many years, designed to help you cut through the nutritional noise and get right to the heart of what it takes to eat well sustainably. And especially want to call attention to, if you are a coach out there and you work with folks on their nutrition, EC has a track you can affiliate with her with the Three Pillars Masterclass, and I highly recommend you do that. You can find all the information at optimizemenutrition.com. And again, April 17th is the deadline, so do not wait. All right, hunger.
Mm.
Let's start with what the heck is hunger?
That's probably a good one. What are we talking about? I think there's a lot of different reasons why we eat. And I think people often think hunger is the reason why we eat. It certainly is one of them, but it's not the only one, right? So when I talk about hunger, it's the need to eat for fuel, right? We need this energy from the macronutrients to breathe, to have a heartbeat, to think, to move our bodies. There is this survival need to eat, of course, and hunger is to make sure that we have the energy present to allow all those processes to take place. I would suggest that for a lot of us in the modern food environment, that's probably not always the primary driver for why we eat. We also eat because we want to eat. And so appetite is the desire to eat. And I really liked how the Gibbons paper in the show notes explains appetite. Quote, appetite forms a bridge between the internal and external environments and therefore has both biological and behavioral psychological aspects. It's not just the internal metabolic need to eat, it incorporates all the influential factors on what to eat and how much to eat, end quote. And so that also means that cravings fall under this definition of appetite. And cravings are when we want this, you know, specific food. And so a good distinction between, okay, well, what's hunger and what's appetite, and or what's hunger and what's cravings, is when you're hungry, you're really willing to eat anything.
Mm-hmm.
Cravings are when you aren't hungry for the chicken or the fruit already prepped in your fridge, but you are, quote, hungry for the chocolate cake, right? Another distinction is hunger comes on relatively gradually. And again, it's about this metabolic or the body's need. And appetite or cravings tend to come on more suddenly. It's in the brain versus the body. And it often is caused by a trigger. Now, the trigger can be lots of different things, from boredom to anxiety, to stress, to environmental cues, to social cues. You know, I was looking at a study, it was kind of interesting, where people ate more when the tables were set for a meal versus when it was like paper plates and paper napkins, implying it was more like a snack, you know? There's also the observation that people tend to finish what's on their plate, even if they don't like it, right? They tend to eat what they're served type of stuff. And so those are a couple examples of environmental cues that can really affect how much we're eating, even though the body doesn't necessarily have a need for that food. So again, hunger is not the only reason we eat. And I think that solving nutrition would be a lot easier if we only ate based right. on need. But instead, we have all of these psychological and behavioral factors that come into the equation for why we eat. And so I think, you know, if we go with a title here about like hacking hunger as the title of this podcast, it's a little bit of clickbait in the sense of, in cases of true hunger, we probably just need to eat. mm-hmm. And I think also that this overlaps a little bit with what's so great about mindful eating approaches. You know, we did an old podcast on intuitive eating, and I don't love the book because some of the claims they make about health, but some of the principles about getting people to figure out why they're eating is super valuable. You know, are you eating because you're hungry? Or are you eating because you're tired? Or are you eating because you just want a break from your computer screen? I mean, I know there's countless times I've walked into the kitchen because I just didn't feel like dealing with the next thing on the to-do list, right? So I think hacking hunger for a lot of people is more about hacking why they are eating when they aren't hungry. Mm-hmm. And that's where they can make significant change than necessarily trying to have willpower when they are legitimately hungry.
Mm. Super interesting. What about cravings? Seems like recognizing boredom or procrastination or, you know, I just don't want to deal with that email right now.
Right.
Might be somewhat easier to, you know, redirect yourself to something other than eating, right? Any number of things, go take a walk, go pet the dog, whatever. So thoughts on like what a better way to handle cravings might be?
Yeah, I do think cravings are probably harder than those. And they are really psychological. And this runs counter. There's a popular belief out there that sometimes people think, oh, I have cravings for foods because of nutrient deficiencies. Like I'm craving dark chocolate because of the magnesium. It's like, no, you're just craving dark chocolate. You know, of course, there are some extreme examples where that's not true. But again, in our affluent environment, it's not going to come down to that. It's going to come down to a psychological need or want. And there's often this trigger or cue that's going to help create that craving. And so trying to figure out what that trigger is for you is kind of the first step here. It could be stress. We've talked about it. Also could be more mundane things though, like time of day. If you always eat chips while watching TV after dinner, you've conditioned yourself to want the chips after dinner. I've also heard this with dessert, right? Sometimes people will have their dinner and then they don't really feel like they're full or the meal is complete until they have something sweet. And it's sort of, okay, yeah, you've done this pairing for 10 to 20 years. You've conditioned yourself to have the sweet with the dinner timing. It's, of course, like the Pavlov's dog experiment, right? And so how to get over this is surprisingly simple in concept, although much harder in application, like most things in nutrition, but it's to stop responding to the trigger. So if you always have chocolate after dinner, the first few days are going to be quite difficult. But after a period of weeks, when you've kind of separated this conditioning or the pairing, you're not going to have that same craving. It's going to be like the craving is lost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if it were so simple to stop the response from the trigger, I don't think we would have the obesity epidemic. And because there's so many different things that are influencing why we want to eat. And semaglutide, which we've talked about before, a popular weight loss drug, it helps kind of dampen your appetite. I can't prescribe drugs as a nutritionist. So from my point of view, my tools are, you know, diet, exercise, behavior change. And so from that point of view, it's okay, what is my trigger and how in the world am I going to decouple my response from that trigger? And in some cases, I think it might be just finding an acceptable stand-in for now, that maybe we aren't going to necessarily stop eating entirely, but what's something that I can put in place that's a better choice from what I'm currently doing? You know, alcohol is kind of a great example here. If somebody wants to cut out their alcohol because either they're just consuming too much or it leads to other mindless eating later, maybe they just switch out their beer with dinner to a non-alcoholic beer. And that can be a nice stand-in that maybe won't be the same trigger for them. Or maybe you always have chocolate before bed or something like that. And it ends up being, you know, the bag of M&Ms. Okay, can we do something like a fudge popsicle or something where we're kind of giving into that pairing that we have and we're kind of getting some satisfaction from it, but it's making a better choice that doesn't necessarily lead to, let's say, the overconsumption of that food or other foods based on that one, like alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. What else do you think that can be done or that folks can do maybe, I don't know if trading is the right word, but just kind of reconsidering that trigger and response towards maybe a more whole food perspective in order to be satisfied, right? Because that's kind of what I'm hearing, right? With the, you know, whatever, homemade ice cream or whatever it is you might replace that with, is at least taking a step in the direction of whole food in order to satisfy not the hunger, because as you're pointing out, it's not really hunger we're responding to, but to satisfy the trigger so we sort of close that loop.
Yeah, I think being satiated, being satisfied, as you mentioned, is going to be our best defense. Yes, that's going to help us if we are truly hungry, but I also think that's going to help with some of the cravings. Now, being satisfied is not necessarily going to end all of the cravings. I'm sure people have had a very filling meal, but they always can still find room for dessert sometimes, right? So
not me.
I can't say that this is going to be a foolproof method against cravings, but it certainly is going to help if you're feeling full and satisfied that you're probably going to have less of those cravings. Okay, so what are the ways that we do that? No surprise, we're going to fill up on whole, unprocessed foods as we've talked about before. But I wanted to bring up a few studies to help kind of illustrate this point beyond what we've said already about things like the 800-gram challenge and lazy macros. So the first one is this whole paper in the show notes. They gave test subjects 240 calories of 38 different foods, and they measured different parameters and behaviors kind of for 2 hours plus after giving them these foods. And one of the things that they measured was what they called the satiety index for these 38 different foods. And they classified them in 6 different categories of like fruits and bakery products and snacks and sweets, which are kind of the same, and protein-rich foods and carbohydrate-rich foods and breakfast cereals. And out of all of these 38 different foods, the most satisfying food by a landslide, even above fruit, even above protein-rich foods, was potatoes. And I wish this is when our podcast had like visuals. I guess YouTube does a little bit, but the graph for how satisfying potatoes were compared to everything, it's like so above and beyond all of the possible foods how much of a front runner it was, right? Which is sort of awesome because we all love potatoes, right? Oh, and this is another important thing. It wasn't french fries. They also tested french fries, and those were way, way, way less satisfying. So we're talking about like boiled potatoes here, right? But then when they started to try to look at, okay, potatoes, amazing. But when they were looking at the trends of what was more satisfying than not, what they found was that the greatest predictor of satiety was the serving size of food, which really comes down to the caloric density, because they were giving each of these people 240 calories of the same food. So for 240 calories, how big of a volume did they get? And so that was the biggest predictor, and no surprise, our less calorically dense things are going to get bigger serving sizes. We've heard about this before. But then they were also looking at, okay, well, let's just beyond the serving size or the exact food, let's look at some of the nutritional characteristics. Turns out that water, fiber, and protein content predicted whether or not they would be more satisfying. And then the calorically dense items, particularly those that were very high in fat, were not satisfying. Sounds a lot like what we promote here with the 800-gram challenge and lazy macros, that if we make those the cornerstone of the diet as foods, not liquids, which tend to be less satisfying, but having those filling foods with water, protein, fiber, we end up being more satisfied.
Okay, so now that we're all on team potato again, or still, there is something kind of counterintuitive to some things that we've heard, that I've heard over the years, about kind of the effect of blood sugar spiking and insulin, in that like, in that we don't want carbs and sugar because of the blood sugar spikes, because then you get hungry and you want more sugar. Like there's this like perception of the there's this doom loop. And that's why we want to avoid something like, or things like potatoes. How does that play into this?
Yeah. I believe that for some period of time as well, that, you know, you have these blood sugar spikes and crashes, and then you're just so hungry for the next blood sugar spike. The literature doesn't really show that that's true, that hunger isn't really based on blood glucose or insulin when within normal levels. So many of our listeners have heard me recommend that book, The Hungry Brain by Stefan Guiene. And so he's got a paper in the show notes, not part of the book, but summarizes this quite well. Quote, meal onset is not causally related to preprandial, meaning before the meal, blood glucose or insulin levels within normal physiological range. Yet the notion that low glucose or elevated insulin levels drive feeding behavior and promote fat gain remains widely popular due largely to the marketing of commercial diet plans based on the glycemic index or reduced carbohydrate content, end quote. So, you know, basically he's saying there that doesn't matter what the insulin or glucose levels are in terms of what the person's going to eat next. And here's some of the evidence for that. So I mentioned that study by Holt. They had a second paper that was off of that same experiment where they gave these 240 calories of 38 different foods to people. They also, in that experiment, besides rating the satiety, they took blood samples every 15 minutes for 2 hours to measure blood glucose, to measure the insulin. And they also then, at the end of the 2 hours, gave them free access to food to see, okay, well, what are they going to eat? So they ate this potato. How much of other food are they going to eat 2 hours later? They gave them this bagel. How much of the other food are they going to eat 2 hours later? And so they were trying to see, okay, how do the blood glucose and insulin levels predict how much that they're going to eat? Well, in terms of satiety, in terms of how full the people felt, there was no significant relationship to their glucose or their insulin levels. So it didn't matter if glucose or insulin was high for the person to feel satisfied, which makes sense, again, in light of what I said about the potatoes. We know that those are kind of higher in carbohydrates, and yet they were the most satisfying food. But I think what's going to be really surprising to our audience is that when they looked at actual food intake, so not just how they felt, like, oh, I feel full, but what did the people actually consume after the 2 hours was up? The test foods with a higher insulin response were associated with less or lower food intake, which led the researchers to conclude that higher carb intake foods were more satisfying than high fat foods. And this wasn't a fluke. There's a Flint paper in the show notes, which is a meta-analysis pulling together research from 7 similar studies like this test food kind of idea. And they split the data a couple different ways, but essentially the higher glucose levels did not result in more hunger or increased food intake, and that higher insulin was associated with decreased hunger, decreased food intake, and increased satiety. And this should now make sense, especially in light of our last week's podcast, in that insulin would be related to satiety if it's the storage hormone, right? Like if insulin goes up when we have all this energy around and we need to be in storage mode, then heck, if insulin's around, it's telling the body, okay, we've got enough energy around. And here's the other thing. It's not just potatoes that I want to touch on. There's a Pat and Ellis paper in the show notes. They were looking at insulin response from protein foods. People forget that insulin goes up after protein. And they found that whey protein produced the greatest insulin response, yet it was the most satisfying, and those people had the least food intake at the next meal. And I want to put out a couple different nuances, because I know of all of the information that's out there in social media land. For people that have insulin resistance or hyperinsulinemia, insulin probably doesn't have the same appetite-suppressing effect for them because they are resistant to the effects of insulin. So when their insulin goes up, they probably don't feel as satisfied as somebody who is not insulin resistant, which kind of makes sense why. And there is no specific diagnostic marker for insulin resistance, but fasting glucose is a great kind of proxy or stand-in, meaning if you have a healthy fasting glucose, you are not insulin resistant, and so you really don't need to be concerned about these blood sugar spikes and falls on a minute-to-minute basis, and it's not dictating your food choices at the next meal. And I also, the other nuance that I want to kind of point out is I know people are going to say that they have experiences that counter this, that they've had this, you know, processed food meal or a more high carbohydrate meal. And then, yes, they are very hungry 2 hours later, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So they're going to have some lived experiences that sort of counter that. And I would suggest a couple things there. One, it could just be that you had some sort of processed food that didn't have a lot of water, protein, or fiber, which really triggers satiety. And so it could be a byproduct of that. It's not necessarily the carbs that are making you hungry. It's the lack of fiber, water, and protein that's making you hungry. And then the other thing is we can't forget that we have lots of different reasons why we eat, including that dopamine response. And that dopamine hit can happen almost immediately after you have some high carbohydrate processed food, and such that you might be wanting something 2 hours later just to have that dopamine hit again. It might have nothing to do with hunger.
Let's maybe do a recap as we close out of this conversation. Let's summarize what we got here around hacking hunger, maybe focusing a little bit on where and how we can actually take action.
Mm. Eat more potatoes. No. Mm-hmm. Done. Well, definitely eat potatoes. They are allowed on the 800-gram challenge. This is one of the many reasons why. But yeah, I mean, I think it comes back to a lot of the stuff that we talk about all the time, filling up on the whole foods, taking advantage of foods where we get that large serving size, which ends up being fruits and veggies and whole food protein sources. Keeping your food environment clear of the stuff that we tend to be their trigger foods. But I think one of the things that I really wanted to point out about keeping the food environment clear is obviously it can help us prevent us from just having that trigger to eat, but keeping the food environment clear also might give us the time to have a reflection of why am I eating, right? Like, am I actually hungry? And to give us that space, that physical time to be able to have just a thought about like, am I hungry? Am I tired? Am I frustrated? Am I just need a break from work? And be able to now start to be able to change the response to that trigger. Because if we keep having such a quick pairing between, okay, I'm stressed out and eat, we're never going to have kind of a way to start getting our habit changed. And so that is another thing that I like to point out about the food environment. It's not just, okay, we want to decrease the calories and but it's giving us the time to now be able to try to insert another response to that trigger.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I can't help but think about if we could also create that space for our, our need for our seeking of things like social media or anything else on the internet, right? If we can figure out how to create enough of a gap that the moment you're bored or stressed or anxious or whatever, the phone isn't in your pocket and it's not one swipe and all of a sudden you're on Instagram or TikTok or whatever. If you can create that little buffer, then you can actually ask yourself, oh, why am I stressed out? Why am I anxious? Am I actually what, you know, all those things. Like it's such a good point to remind us that like we don't live in an environment that's really built for our success in these ways. We live in an environment that's in fact like over indexing towards convenience and ease and all these other things. And so we have to work really hard to remove those things from our environment because everybody keeps trying to jam them back in there.
Totally. I agree.
Super interesting. Thank you, EC. Thank you, everybody out there, for listening. Thank you for your ratings and your reviews. Thanks for sharing the show with your friends. EC and I'll be back next week for another episode of the Consistency Project Podcast.